You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. The name of this program is The Great Leap Forward. This program can be heard every Wednesday night here on Free Radio Santa Cruz from 7 to 9 p.m. You can listen to Free Radio on the World Wide Web at www.microradio.net/FRSC. Free Radio Santa Cruz is in its eighth year of broadcasting without a license from the U.S. government. This program is dedicated to exploring nonviolence and anarchism and social change and spiritual growth. Tonight you'll hear an interview with Norman Solomon. Norman Solomon is the founder and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, a consortium of policy researchers and analysts. He is a nationally syndicated columnist since 1992 and has written 10 books, including Unreliable Sources, The Habits of Highly Deceptive Media, which won the George Orwell Award for Distinguished Contribution to Honesty and Clarity in Public Language. Solomon's op-ed pieces on media and politics have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, and most other major U.S. newspapers. He is an associate of the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. I spoke with Norman Solomon on Friday, March 21st, 2003, just 48 hours or so after George W. Bush and the U.S. government began its new war on Iraq. I spoke with Norman Solomon in San Francisco in between his appearances on KQED and on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation Network. We went to the Independent Television Network studio in San Francisco, where he was broadcast live, interviewed live for Canadian television. And in fact, we had to take a break during the interview so that he could do that broadcast. Here now is Norman Solomon, whose latest book is called Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. And Reese Ehrlich is the co-author. The introduction is by Howard Zinn, and the afterword is by Sean Penn, who joined Norman Solomon on a recent trip to Iraq. And again, that book is called Target Iraq, and it's out on Context Books. Here now is Norman Solomon on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Norman Solomon, thanks for speaking with me today. Iraq was bombed 46 times during 2002 by the United States and Britain. And just 2 days ago, in the early morning hours in Baghdad, Iraq, the United States government began a new war on Iraq. And many people around the world were hoping and demonstrating for a peaceful resolution and not for this war. What are your feelings in these first days, and what has been your observation of U.S. media coverage in these first days?
The people under the bombs are not rendered as real in U.S. news media, and so we have this kind of through-the-looking-glass, objectified, abstracted, rendered in pixels sort of representation of people, if that. It's, to me, a major disconnect, and I think many people in this country and around the world feel that way. The notion that we understand what's happening because the symbols and verbiage are provided to us by journalists and politicians and pundits and so forth. It's hard to think of a more diametrically different experience than watching television, to be near the bombs that are now falling on Baghdad and elsewhere in Iraq, including in obviously some very heavily populated urban areas. So I think we're very much into a newspeak zone, not only in terms of what I call the hot, voluminous hot air of the foundation of rationalizing the war, but really at kind of a feeling level, the numbing, the desensitization, the euphemisms, the Orwellian language.
You're about to go on the air on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation to be on television. How much more is your viewpoint and viewpoints that are critical of the United States government and describing propaganda, how much more are you being contacted by other countries, broadcasters from other countries rather than the United States?
Well, today I've been contacted by a print journalist from a magazine in Mexico, a reporter who was on the air in Ireland, a BBC program broadcast inside Britain, and now also the CBC. It seems that when the war starts, the U.S. news media, especially the large ones, back off a bit, even from, frankly, the fairly token access that people with my perspective have gotten in the months leading up to this war. I was on CNN, half a dozen times in February and early March of this year. I don't really expect to be invited back very much now that the war is underway. Mm. I don't think I'd fit in with the kind of the mood of the news media where dissent is really being shunted aside, and now it's more like, you know, covering Wild Kingdom, you know, covering the protesters in their natural habitat, which is out in the streets getting arrested, holding signs, chanting, holding candles, but to actually engage in much discourse, even the limited extent to which we had that going on even in the lead up to the war, has subsided, at least for a time. The space is just narrowing, and I expect that to continue for a while.
President-elect George W. Bush has said that the United States government needs to attack Iraq because of Saddam Hussein's connection to the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, and because of Hussein's development of weapons of mass destruction. What evidence is there for those arguments, and what do you think is the actual underlying motivation for this increased attack and destruction of Iraq?
Well, even the White House doesn't claim that Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11, but the administration does claim that Saddam Hussein has ties to al-Qaeda and terrorist networks and so forth. There's really no substantive evidence. I mean, you have a few people inside Iraq tied to groups that are tied, we're told, to al-Qaeda. They, though, are based in areas not controlled at this moment, as of now anyway, in areas controlled by Americans, not by Saddam Hussein's regime. And the lack of a connection between 9/11 and al-Qaeda on one hand and Saddam Hussein's regime on the other doesn't seem to have stopped the message from getting out there. It's just the power of repetition. Part of the essence of propaganda is repetition. So after the umpteenth time of having heard that there is a connection between Saddam Hussein and terrorism, such as that propagated by the al-Qaeda network, people tend to take that seriously and believe that it must be the case. That's at least a pretty widespread, if we're to believe the polls. Maybe half the people in the United States came to believe that.
Even though it's completely false?
Well, yeah, there's no evidence for it. But in a way, evidence is almost beside the point because it's the propagation of a worldview. 9/11 is presented by the White House and to some extent by news media as a license to kill. And the U.S. government then has the purported right to attack any government that's deemed to be possibly a threat in the future.
You have come out with a book, it's your latest book, Target Iraq, and you describe in it your recent visits to Iraq. Tell me what you learned and what you saw and what you heard from the Iraqi people.
I didn't really hear a lot from Iraqi people. I did meet some, talk to a few. It is a police state. It's hard to gauge what the genuine feelings are. Certainly a lot of people in Iraq have hated Saddam Hussein. And at the same time, getting bombed was not their generally favored scenario. And I think there's a dilemma there where Saddam Hussein has been holding hostages, so to speak, the population of Iraq. The U.S., with Britain's help, has proceeded to bomb the hostages, which I think is a pretty terrible idea.
You have written in Target Iraq about the United States government exploiting the fears and anxieties of people in the United States regarding September 11th, 2001. And in George W. Bush's speech the other night when bombing began of Baghdad, he said that the people of the United States and our friends and allies will not live at the mercy of an outlaw regime that threatens the peace with weapons of mass murder. He went on to say, we will meet that now with our Army, Air Force, Navy, Coast Guard, and Marines, so that we do not have to meet it later with armies of firefighters and police and doctors on the streets of our cities. Obviously, a reference to September 11th. It seems really important that these things are separated and that they have been connected for people. Unfortunately, people are legitimately afraid about what happened on September 11th, and the United States government is using that. Do you have any more comments about that?
Well, we have an entire chapter in the book called Spinning 9/11, and really, you know, as you say, this fear is genuine. The assertions by the Bush administration people that these issues should be connected, Iraq and terrorism, is, I think, not supported by evidence, but has a powerful grip emotionally. And the rhetoric coming out of Bush's mouth as the war has gotten underway really is well scripted. They've got good script writers, rhetoricians. Unfortunately, that's what it is. It's rhetoric without factual foundation. I think we should probably need to pause here.
You're listening to an interview with Norman Solomon, media critic and author of Target Iraq. At that point in the interview, he had to go on the air to do a live interview for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Here again is Norman Solomon and the interview we did last Friday. You were just on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation on television being interviewed, and you mentioned that the media here in the United States is doing a good job for the Pentagon. Tell me a little more.
Well, those questions about how good a job are the news outlets doing really begs the question about the question, what is that for? What is that about? And the question becomes, how do we evaluate the way in which questions are framed? So this is all kind of a long-winded way of saying that when I'm asked, are the journalists doing a good job? You have to kind of define in your answer what the heck we mean by a good job. So in this case, yeah, the journalists at this point are doing a superb job for the Pentagon. The kind of imagery that is being sought by the image shapers at the Pentagon, with few exceptions so far, and we're a few days into the all-out war, those images are pretty much coming across. So the services are being provided. That's why it sometimes is appropriate to refer to journalists as stenographers for the powerful when they don't go outside the narrow range of concepts and imagery that are preferred by those in power. The reliance on official sources to a great degree determines the kind of coverage that we're going to see. And I think authentic independent journalism would be way different than what we're getting. It would be assertive. As I said on the air, it would have other sources, for instance, not just embedding the journalists in the troop units that are on the attack, but also embed journalists with families in Iraq who are at the other end of the missiles. And when we get to that point, then we'll know that there's been some shift in coverage. But the journalists are not deployed under the missiles. Obviously, it's dangerous. They're not deployed with those families. And it has to do with humanizing the attackers and dehumanizing those at the other end of the missiles. And I think that's a key point. When you're in a situation where human interest story after human interest story talks about the bravery, the humanity, the compassion, the caring, the stress, the fear of the soldiers in the U.S. and British militaries who are attacking, well, that would be well and good if you also had strong emphasis on the humanity of the people being slaughtered by those armies, human beings who predictably, I don't want to, you know, no matter how accurate those weapons may be, predictably the people at the other end are going to be in very real human terms, harmed, terrorized, often killed, in terms of the numbers. I mean, there were 100,000 people killed during the Gulf War, civilians, Iraqis, I should say, during the Gulf War. Stephen Zunis has that estimate in his recent excellent book called Tinderbox. 15,000 of those were civilians. It remains to be seen, this war in 2003, the death toll. But, you know, if we're going to have a war, we should face directly, as best we can, the human consequences. And when the war is built on what I call the enormously vacuous hot air chambers that have sought to justify the war as valid, as legal, as appropriate, then you kind of compound the crime against humanity. War is always horrible in human terms. To wage war in a situation where the rationales for the war are bogus, I mean, I just think that is incredibly outrageous, and that's what war crimes trials are for. I mean, as of now, George W. Bush is a war criminal, so is Rumsfeld, so is Powell. That's reality, but you got to be able to enforce some kind of human rights standards with the ability to put people on trial. And obviously, we're in a situation where the operative principle, if you can call it that, is might makes right.
In these weeks leading up to this war now in 2003, the United Nations was not supporting this, and there was even what should have been huge stories about the United States government spying on member countries of the UN Security Council. I'm curious your take on that whole spying, and also what kind of power and legitimacy does now the United Nations and world courts, this sort of realm, have?
Well, a lot of people in the upper reaches of the Bush administration really don't believe in the UN as anything other than an instrument of U.S. foreign policy. And you have this rhetoric that the United Nations makes itself irrelevant, which is just a way of saying that to the extent that the UN doesn't bend to the will of Washington, it's irrelevant. And it's only, quote unquote, relevant to the extent that it does the bidding of the man in the Oval Office. Well, that's preposterous. That's an absurd sort of a definition of what a world body should be, what the United Nations ought to be. I think the progression of events is such that the way in which the United States ran roughshod over the UN Security Council really exposes the basic perspective, and certainly it weakens the claim, although the claim continues to be made, of legitimacy for this war. So I think it was fairly transparent, but there is, as I say, this de facto axiom of might makes right. It's very tough for governments around the world to buck the power of the U.S.
In your book, Target Iraq, you quote and mention George Orwell a number of times. Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. What do you think are the strongest examples currently of U.S. government doublespeak regarding Iraq? And also, what do you think George Orwell might have to say if he were alive now?
Orwell would have a lot to say, and as you point out, we quote him in our book, Target Iraq. We're also in kind of a Kafkaesque as well as Orwellian land. It's some kind of blend there. A lot of the buzz phrases, I think, have to do with, for instance, we are hearing again and again from White House officials that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass murder. And it's a phrase that's really come to the fore here in mid-late March 2003. Interestingly, a phrase that has been mouthed by the president, by Donald Rumsfeld, as the United States proceeds to engage in mass murder. So there's some kind of projection going on. What are you going to call these cruise missiles, these 2,000-pound bombs? You can pretty them up, as Rumsfeld tries to do. You can almost worship them, as is often the case on the cable TV footage and the narratives. We're in the midst of kind of a macabre media love affair with high-tech weaponry, what's been called the gods of metal, the
worship of these instruments of death, which are, I suppose you could say, of impressive technical capability. And so it just goes to show you that technology is not going to solve any human problems. It's really a matter of the precepts that really guide organized human behavior. And right now it's a lot about profit and geopolitical domination. The weapons are worshipped quite often, in effect, but we need to go deeper, much deeper, to analyze what that's about.
George W. Bush has said that this attack, this new war on Iraq, is about bringing freedom and democracy to the people of Iraq. If that were even true, what is the state of freedom and democracy in the United States that he would be offering?
Well, I think there's diminishing freedom. I mean, certainly we have the First Amendment, it's very precious and so forth, but there is a kind of a repressive tolerance, to use a phrase that was written by Herbert Marcuse several decades ago. And the usefulness of the First Amendment depends on the energy that people utilize. It's kind of a use it or lose it situation. Clearly, the space for civil liberties has been narrowed since 9/11. The Ashcroft Justice Department has been putting in many restrictions with help from Congress. And, you know, we have some democratic freedoms, but they've been largely neutralized and suppressed under the guise of national security. And after 9/11, that's been a very useful rhetorical and political tool from the powers that be.
A lot of people are concerned about this and losing their civil liberties. And there has been the creation of Homeland Security, the Office of Information Awareness, even library awareness programs. And a lot of people are aware of the counterintelligence program of the FBI from the past. And I know that you have discovered through Freedom of Information files on yourself that go back to 1966. Tell me, what were you doing in 1966, and how old were you? And tell me about these files.
Well, I was 15 years old in 1966. I guess I'd gone to picket against segregation and housing in Maryland at that point, so somehow my name got slipped in there. I was a high school student organizer in 1968-69, and apparently there were a number of pages when I filed for my Freedom of Information Act request. Most of it blacked out, actually, but it included some pages about that. Of course, we were doing free speech sort of activities, organizing for school reform, implicitly anti-war anyway at that point. And so, you know, there you go. Got to keep, I guess, the spies busy.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is the importance of peaceful protest, or more specifically, nonviolence, in resisting war and bringing true democracy to the United States?
Bringing true democracy to the United States, I think that's going to be an ongoing challenge. I think it's going to be a very tough thing that's involved with utilizing the freedoms that we have, finding ways to make them real, because just having them chiseled in stone or on parchment is not going to do it. We need ways to actualize, and that means activism, it means speaking out, it means bringing the First Amendment alive. I say that the corporations largely are sitting on the windpipe of the First Amendment. We need to push them off and enliven our capability to really have democratic discourse. Ultimately, that's really our only hope. As Eduardo Galeano said, when he was speaking at the First World Social Forum in 2001, that the greatest truth is the search for truth. And I think he's right. You know, the truth is not something you just grab hold of. It's really a quest and a process that should be ongoing.
And I'm reminded that Gandhi's autobiography was titled The Story of My Experiments with Truth. And he and Martin Luther King Jr., of course, led successful movements for social change. And many people all over the world have cultivated a view that returning evil for evil is not a positive way of dealing with violence. And you, in the book Target Iraq that you've just come out with, in the chapter Spinning 9/11, Terrorism and Weapons of Mass Destruction, it begins with a quote from W.H. Auden, "Those to whom evil is done do evil in return." But as I was mentioning, a lot of people have actually embraced a different way of social change, and it includes spiritual growth. And I know that you yourself have worked in social change for many years, including with the Fellowship of Reconciliation. And there are many others who bring together social change and spiritual growth. The Catholic Workers, Engaged Buddhists, Quakers, and I mentioned Mohandas Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr. What is your own experience with spiritual practice, and what does spiritual practice have to do with social change, in your view?
Personally, I don't have really any formal study or theology around spiritual practice. I'm very, again, personally, leery of ritual. I don't care for ritual of any formalized sort. I'm wary of theology. I, again, personally, consider myself a spiritual person, but I kind of think the more, in a sense, we try to formalize what being spiritual means, you end up, you kind of have to take people's word for it. They say, "I'm spiritual." Well, okay, because it's all about manifestation, and you can't really know what's going on inside a person. It's hard enough to know what's going on inside oneself. I think having a what's been called spiritual connection to the world is important. It's hard to get a handle on, so to speak. It's much more wispy. If we don't have very strong human connections with each other, I think we will perish even while we're alive. We will just kind of waste away. And that's, I think, very real. There are a lot of conundrums around the spiritual and fear, I believe. And often we hold on to whatever out of fear, and we feed fear, which is part of life. I think somehow moving in the direction of doing, in a sense, what we're afraid of is very helpful if it's an activity that resonates for us, and if not overcoming our fears, at least living with them with eyes open. And activism, to me, is the best alternative available in cognizance of the kind of world that we live in, which includes great beauty. Nature, to me, is the antithesis of war and exploitation. And obviously, there's a war on nature. There's exploitation of nature, and these are concentric issues, I think. How do we, as individuals, as a culture, as a society, move beyond the exploitive models and so forth? I really feel being spiritual may or may not be essential to political activism. It probably, again, these are slippery words. It may or may not be essential to activism, but even if it were, it's, let's just say for the sake of discussion, it would be necessary. It's not sufficient, and we need to encounter with the real world and be active and be engaged with real life daily experience.
I often think of spirituality as being the development of compassion, to put it as simply as possible. And it is hard to know what is meant by spirituality. And I think a lot of activists, people involved in social change, have thrown out religion and spirituality because they don't like ritual. It's represented also hierarchical institutions. But to bring it down to compassion, development of compassion, maybe I could ask you if you can offer more about yourself in terms of you're doing work that I view as very compassionate. You're concerned with the suffering of others. Is there somewhere that you can describe where that has come from for you?
Well, it's not something I talk about very often. especially in public. I mean, my basic feeling is that compassion is as compassion does. And I kind of put it in that same bailiwick of if people say they're compassionate, well, okay. Again, we're kind of impelled or encouraged just to take people's word for it. It's all, I mean, there's the internal experience, and then there's how it's manifested. And the internal experience can only be known by that one person. The how it's manifested is clear. I mean, George W. Bush has called himself a compassionate conservative, so obviously the words are easy to come by. For me, I have felt, I would say, and of course these are words, these are approximations, I think empathy and compassion are very close together. And maybe compassion is overlaps quite often with empathy. I think there's that, there's an element of not just being passive, you might say, empathy without passivity, or empathy with moving with empathy can be actualized as active compassion. And so I've been leery of compassion as a passive concept. I mean, to me, again, it's necessary but not sufficient to feel the compassion. Since I was a child, I felt empathy quite often. I learned more about people as I grew older, and it became more evident to me that it wasn't enough to feel, it was necessary to live out through some kind of affirmative activity what one feels in terms of empathy and connection.
To return to current events that are happening, the United States and Britain are bombing Iraq heavily now. Baghdad, there are ground troops moving up from the south. And apparently, we're hearing from mainstream news that 2 U.S. Marines have been killed, and 4 U.S. soldiers and 8 British soldiers died in a helicopter crash. We're not hearing about Iraqi deaths, which seems typical that we wouldn't be hearing about that yet. I wonder if you'd comment on that sort of reporting. And also, in the book Target Iraq, there's some discussion of U.S. plans already for post-war Iraq. And there's the mention of Ahmed Khalabi, who I've actually never heard very much about. Maybe you can tell me a little more about these supposed plans and who he is.
Well, he's one of the supposed exile leaders who most Iraqis, I think, have never heard of. In the book, we mention that oil, in our assessment, Reese Ehrlich and I believe that oil is a big factor, but not the only factor in the war. When you look at the fact there are 112 billion barrels of oil estimated to be under the ground inside the country of Iraq, clearly a huge, huge financial value there. And you know, if there was no oil in Iraq, I don't think there would be a war going on. That's the so-called real world. And we have the challenge to look at it clearly and confront it as best we can.
In your trips to Iraq, I wonder what you saw in terms of the results of sanctions that have been going on for many years, and also depleted uranium that has been used in armaments by the United States and other countries against Iraq.
Reese Ehrlich did the reporting on the ground about depleted uranium, and I think he has written a really good chapter in the book just showing some of the questions that have arisen from doing the investigation. It's very tough to do the epidemiology, but clearly there's a significant risk there of harming people, and to the Pentagon that risk is not a concern because it's a good hard target piercing material for projectiles to use depleted uranium. The broader question was what I saw in terms of sanctions. Yeah, we have some information. Again, Reese wrote a good chapter in our book about sanctions. I went to the Children's Hospital a couple of times during my visits to Iraq, the Al Mansour Pediatric Teaching Hospital, and to see the children dying through, really, and we explain this in the book, through a lack of access to easily available pharmaceutical drugs, but drugs that are blocked. It's not about money for those drugs. It's about blocked from importation by the 661 UN committee, as it's called, where the U.S. had been for years, and as we speak, has continued to block the importation of literally life-saving chemotherapy drugs. It's just an example of what's involved.
Hmm. Sort of in relation to depleted uranium, which, of course, is not selective in who it affects. It affects the troops that brought it there as well, and Gulf War syndrome has affected a lot of folks that were there in earlier years. And I know you did a lot of research in the past regarding the effect of radiation on World War II veterans who went to Japan after the nuclear bombs were dropped there. What did you find out about that?
Well, I had co-written a book called Killing Our Own, The Disaster of America's Experience with Atomic Radiation, which was published in 1982. And it's kind of paradigmatic, if that's a word. It really is a way in which during warfare and military pursuits, during nuclear weapons testing and of course, horrible use in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and then nuclear tests after World War II, the U.S. government always downplayed and denied the dimensions of human health impacts. And in the Killing Our Own book, Harvey Wasserman and I really walked through the emerging evidence at that point, which has gotten much stronger since then, that ionizing radiation is not the benign force that so often the Pentagon and U.S. establishment tend to claim it is.
In the prologue to Target Iraq, you wrote, every government is run by liars and nothing they say should be believed. This is actually a quote from I.F. Stone. Tell me about that idea and how much faith, if you have any, in change through government systems and legislation.
Well, I'm not an anarchist. I was more anarchistically inclined 20, 25 years ago. I believe that we need government, but I think that it should serve people instead of the other way around, and it should be truly democratic. And unfortunately, that quote from I.F. Stone is all too real. I would say that it's not a matter of all governments lie all the time, nor is it a matter of conflating all governments. But I think I.F. Stone's point is that we always must refuse to take on faith the statements of governments because there is such an institutionalized preference for deception from government officials.
Thanks so much for speaking with me, Norman, and thank you for your work.
Oh, thank you, John.
You just heard an interview with Norman Solomon, media critic and author of Target Iraq, along with Rhys Ehrlich. Target Iraq is now available in bookstores and is an important book to read at this time. I spoke with Norman Solomon last Friday, March 21st, 2003. Little less than 2 days after the United States government began its new war on Iraq. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. The name of this program is The Great Leap Forward. Stay tuned right here to Free Radio Santa Cruz. Here now is a brief interview with Chris Cornell, former lead singer of the band Soundgarden, and now singing with Audioslave, which is a new band that includes Tom Morello, guitarist from Rage Against the Machine. And I spoke with Chris Cornell last Wednesday evening after their show at the Warfield in San Francisco. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. What are your feelings about what's been announced this evening? George Bush came on the radio and on television.
I'm sad because I didn't see that.
I heard on the radio on NPR about 6:30 that some bombs had exploded in Baghdad, and he came on the radio, the president-elect of the United States, saying that this was the beginning of a large campaign, a large attack on the people of Iraq, although he put it as a way of liberating the people of Iraq. Mm-hmm. So that started. We've all been hoping this wouldn't happen. There's been large protests, a lot of countries, and people have come out against it. And mm-hmm. tonight, it's started and it's happening.
Well, my feelings go back. They start, I guess, with the way that he got elected. I have a huge problem with that. I don't think that we would be in this war if Bush hadn't eventually taken the office of the presidency, and I think he got that because of the electoral system, which is archaic now. He didn't get the popular vote, so that's the first part that bothers me, and anything that he's done that's bothered me is that it irks me that it doesn't feel like real democracy with him as president. What's happened to the economy? He plays a part in it, but it was going that way anyway. What happens when he assembles American troops and American equipment somewhere where it's costing Americans billions of dollars, and then trying to use any tool that he can, whether it's to like fictitiously come up with like a Code Orange, which he did a few weeks ago, because it was obvious that the American people weren't backing his ideas. Well, now it's Code Orange, and trying to get people scared and think, well, yeah, maybe we should go to war. That didn't work. He doesn't want to give Iraq and the UN any time because he set us up for war, and it's costing billions a day if we're there and we're not attacking. So it seems to me like about, since several weeks ago, no matter what happens, he's going to do this. No matter what the country feels like, he's going to do this. No matter what Hussein does, he's going to do something. It's like this was not going to be stopped by anybody. It was just going to be their attempts, different attempts at spinning it and trying to make it look in whatever way is the best way they want it to look to the public at the time. And I have felt really helpless. I've felt scared, really sad, and really angry to be an American and to feel like suddenly this country has changed and the American version of democracy has changed to the point where something like this can happen with this much resistance and with worldwide resistance from people whom we've had good relationships before, ignoring them. I don't feel any immediate threat from Iraq. There hasn't been any immediate threat from Iraq to the United States or anyone else as far as I know. So the urgency, I think, is ridiculous. It's clear to me that it has to be for economic reasons and possibly for re-election reasons. Although the only way he could get re-elected is if they go in and they kick ass, take names, kill Saddam Hussein, take over, put in their puppet regime, just like they've done in Afghanistan. And then what, as citizens of this country, do we do? Because there's plenty of other Middle Eastern countries and plenty of other directions. He's just, in half a year, if he manages to take over too, how are these other countries going to feel about it? How are these other countries going to feel about me personally as an American? without going and talking to somebody, really, everything that he does reflects on you or I as citizens of this country. So I'm frustrated, angry.
You said tonight at the show, during the show, that you're angry about helping to pay for this.
Sure. Yeah, I've believed for years that there should be allocation clauses on tax forms. In other words, you know, maybe not 100% of your taxes, obviously, but like some percentage, 13, 15, 20%, 25% of your taxes go to where you decide they go. So what's important to you is where part of your money goes. You know, when I first started thinking about that, I thought about, well, who pays the most taxes? Now, most major corporations figure out ways to not. So really, it could be the middle class and the lower classes that actually collectively pay the most taxes. And if they're making a decision, you know, 25% each per tax payment, it could really change the way things are running, and it could change the way where money goes, so that me as a taxpayer have a certain amount of say as to where my money goes. And it irks me, considering how much taxes I do pay, that I'm paying for something that I don't want to be happening. It makes me sad, it makes me scared, it makes me feel like moving, you know, although where would I go, you know, what place do I find that I would agree with more? Wherever I go, they're going to want my money, know, and I can't help but feeling like if I'm giving them money, then to a degree I'm condoning it or I'm enabling them. Like the commercials where they say, if you snort coke, then you're actually helping this cartel kill judges and priests who are against them. It's the same theory. You know, if I'm paying taxes, I'm helping the current administration bomb innocent people. And if I stop paying taxes, they take everything I have and put me in jail. So what do I get to do? I don't know. So I'm frustrated, pissed off, and it's a hard day for me today because of it.
Did you have any feelings about maybe not playing the show tonight?
No, I don't think that would have been a good idea at all. You know, I think a place for everybody to go and just listen to music. I think that even though my lyrics aren't an overtly political message, they certainly get people to tune in to their feelings. You know, and I played one song specifically that's a protest song to a degree and talked about it a little, but ultimately just tried to make it a moment for all of us to have where we're all entertained and all kind of in one room and have intimacy within the group. And I felt that big time tonight. That felt good. It's probably a good place to be as far as this being the first night that they're bombing, which is a surprise to me, to be in San Francisco and play this show. I'm happy to be here doing that.
How radicalized do you think people are in the United States? There's been a lot of huge protests, and people have learned a lot from civil rights movement and the women's movement, all these movements. People seem prepared to do something. And also, how important do you think nonviolence is in that movement?
I think you never really seem to get enough people in terms of a nonviolent approach. It would take a lot of people. I mean, unions would literally have to join in a protest, and you know, then they're in danger. That puts them in danger. It would be great if they did. I mean, it would be great if we shut this country down. I think we could make a difference, definitely. And I think set a precedence to any. To any president, to any regime that's around that shows up the next time, it could set a precedence of, wow, if this kind of mobilization can happen. How you do that, I don't know. But we'll see what happens. We'll see how people feel. I think that this country will be motivated, especially if they see some serious backlash from other countries that were against it in the first place. You know, what's the point in anybody voting on UN resolutions when they're just ignored and we're just pulling strings doing whatever we want? and intimidating everybody so nobody can really do anything about it. At some point, somebody's going to stop letting this happen, and then what is that going to mean? You know, are we going to be at war on our own soil in our own country with somebody? Or is it just trading warheads, that kind of thing? That's all frightening. I have a 2.5-year-old daughter, and I often end up trying to put this kind of stuff out of my mind. I listened on NPR to a lecture that a woman was giving about the capabilities of the warheads that we have now and what that means. And she was talking about ground zero and then mileage. This much damage happens within 5 miles, this much within 50, this much within... if one warhead gets dropped that causes, you know, a response that is also a nuclear warhead, it changes the world forever in a horrible way. And that's pretty terrifying. And I think right now this country is really showing itself as an aggressor and showing itself pretty blatantly using a pretty thin excuse to dominate parts of the Middle East that it can get away with. Mm-hmm. And that's scary. Mm-hmm. I know we're stealing countries right now. Mm-hmm. Hitler did that. Mm-hmm. Napoleon did that. The British did that. I'm not sure, you know, I'm not sure a lot of Americans really understand what's going on and what that can mean to us, and what that can mean to an American that's loved being an American, you know? Mm-hmm. It doesn't want to go live somewhere else. So I'm not having a very good day right now.
And that's it.
I mean, I think we can kind of end it with that. Mm-hmm. I don't mind.
Thanks for your time. Sure. Would you mind giving me a station ID? That was Chris Cornell, lead singer for the new band Audio Slave. Former lead singer for Soundgarden, talking about the new war on Iraq. My view really is that the Gulf War of 1991 never really ended. The United States and Britain continued bombing Iraq since then, all these years, imposed sanctions on that country, and generally wreaked havoc and destruction on the people of Iraq. Recently, I spoke with Kathy Kelly, co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness, and she is now in Baghdad, enduring the bombing. And that interview is being printed in These Times magazine and will be available at bookstores and newsstands probably tomorrow or the next day around the country. That's In These Times magazine. And the entire interview can be read at their website, which is inthesetimes.com. They have titled the article Catching Courage, which I think is very appropriate. Kathy Kelly is a very courageous leader in the nonviolent struggle against oppression and the violent actions of the United States government. On the cover of the issue of In These Times that's coming out tomorrow, it says Bush versus the world. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3 FM. We are now in our 8th year of broadcasting without a license from the FCC and the U.S. government. We exist because of generous contributions from our listeners and from benefit programs that we put on here in the Santa Cruz area. If you'd like to call in to make a donation, please do that. Or if you'd like to call in just to express your thoughts and comments, the number here is 831-427-3772. And Free Radio Santa Cruz broadcasts live 24 hours a day on the World Wide Web at www.microradio.net/FRSC. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM.
from Audio Slave, and you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3.
After some time has passed, you can see more clearly. But in the heat of it, people, people just react. I'm including myself. So bad, and then we want everyone to feel our pain. That's how we go on. That's how we do wrong. Love and compassion. Slip away. A prayer for peace. What a quaint, what a tender notion. When from sea to shining sea, we've been choked with rhetoric, made sick with rhetoric, force-fed on rhetoric. All those lies. The news broadcasts so hard. Ah, but they're selling cars. And love and compassion don't travel far. Me and my circle, and there you are. And once you're on a path, I suppose you're on a path. I suppose you can expect repercussions. Although the blessed, they like to act surprised. In consternation ask, why do they? Are in our hearts, generous and free is how we are. A prayer for peace. What a quaint, what a tender notion. Please grant us.
Think of about that and they talk about justified wars.
Love and compassion.
When it comes right down to it, they can say what they please.
Love and compassion.
But I don't want to terrorize the world to protect my luxuries.
Love and compassion.
I don't want to terrorize the world to protect my luxuries.
Thank you.
You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM.
This research was completed while I was an entity on Earth, while vying to be not of the Earth. It was supported by the main sustainer.